My fellow Americans, we have to be different than this. America has to be better than this. And I believe America is so much better than this. Just look around.
In his first moments as president, Joe Biden used his inauguration address to describe an aspirational vision of America, a nation united domestically, respected internationally, and an exemplar of goodness to our neighbors. And the Biden administration put immigration right at the heart of that vision. In the first 100 days, President Biden used executive orders to reverse many Trump-era immigration practices and sent a significant reform package to the Congress with hopes of changing the nation's immigration policies. Nearly a year later, the Biden administration's stance on immigration is less clear. On Monday, the Biden administration restarted the Trump-era border program known as Remain in Mexico. It forces asylum seekers coming from the U.S.'s southern border to wait in Mexico for their immigration hearings. And the Biden administration ended the policy shortly after his inauguration, but was ordered to restart this contentious program in August after a federal judge ruled that the administration had improperly halted it. The Supreme Court upheld that decision on appeal. Now, under the Trump administration, asylum seekers and migrants who were affected by this Remain in Mexico policy often lived in tent camps, and according to the nonprofit Human Rights First, hundreds faced murder, rape, torture, kidnapping, and other violent assaults. The reinstatement of the Remain in Mexico policy has been criticized by advocates, lawyers, and human rights groups, and Biden himself campaigned on ending the program. Here's Biden during a debate with Trump last fall.
This is the first president in the history of the United States of America that anybody seeking asylum has to do it in another country. That's never happened before in America. They're sitting in squalor on the other side of the river.
The Biden administration recently negotiated with Mexico to provide better conditions for asylum seekers, and the Department of Homeland Security announced in October new plans to terminate the program. But even as the Biden administration has tried to distance itself from its predecessor, like this.
We were briefed on the steps needed to clean up the humanitarian disaster that the Trump administration has systematically created on our southern border. We will institute humane and orderly responses.
The White House is now expanding the scope of who will be sent back across the border to include people from non-Spanish-speaking countries like Haiti, which was not previously in the policy. The Biden administration has also continued the Trump-era emergency pandemic policy known as Title 42 that allows the U.S. to expel migrants for public health reasons without allowing them to request asylum. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and today on The Takeaway, we're looking into why the Biden administration's approach to immigration appears so similar to the policies of its predecessor, policies that Democrats and the president himself previously criticized.
America has to be better than this.
Aura Bogado, who is senior reporter and producer at Reveal from the Center of Investigative Reporting, is here with me now. Welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks so much for having me on.
So is this just a matter of the Biden administration's hands being tied by the federal courts and not having any choice but to reinstate and move forward with the Remain in Mexico policy?
No, you know, I think there's a lot of choice. You referred to some of the promises that Biden made as a candidate. And obviously, when a candidate makes such a big political promise, such as ending MPP, there's an understanding that there's a strategy at play. And I think a lot of us are left wondering what that strategy was. Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas issued memos to stop this program without so much as soliciting a public comment period, right? The administration could have then heard from stakeholders, including what happens to people, to actual human beings as a result of this policy, which you just mentioned, right? Shelters in Mexico are already at capacity. And so one might think like, oh, that's too bad. People have to stay in Mexico. The weather might not be as nice, or maybe there's not enough room at the shelter. But it's so much more serious than that. We're talking about rape. We're talking about torture. We're talking about very, very violent deaths, such as being stabbed to death. Right. And, you know, I think that one misconception here, too, is that the Supreme Court, it didn't assert really anything that the lower court said. It simply declined a request to stop the lower court's injunction. Right. Biden also expanded MPP. He expanded this program. And I think that's really important to remember. That's a choice. It's now broader than it was under Trump. Haitians weren't included in the Trump program, and now Haitians are included in MPP under Biden. The entire Western Hemisphere is.
And why do you think that is?
And that's a really good question, right? I don't report out of DC, but you know, there has been some pretty good reporting coming out of what's happening at the White House. And you know, I think that certain advisors, Susan Rice in particular, have been informing Biden in a way. He gets to choose who his aides are. You know, Susan Rice reportedly barred COVID vaccines to immigrants and to migrants in custody, right? She's apparently backed the deportation of those Haitian migrants that we saw, you know, on the southern border after mounted police were going after them with lariats, right? Who you surround yourself with is important. Biden is... he is the president of the United States. He is arguably the most powerful person in the world. And he's making a choice, right? And a lot of those choices are counter to what he promised as candidate.
Now, the Biden administration also continues to implement Title 42 to expel adult migrants. What is going on? And again, do you have a sense of that? Is that similarly about... sort of this sense of not being politically viable for them, you know, by their own understanding, to make a more, you know, might be described as some as humane choice, might be described as some as a more open bordered choice,
or as a choice to have an effective asylum system, right? Which is one of the unique features, sort of, in the world about of the United States, right? It's a long-standing thing here. Title 42 effectively bars asylum seekers at the southern border on this premise of public health. CDC doctors in particular, you know, didn't believe that it had any backing, and the Trump administration pushed it through anyway. It's always remained under Biden. Title 42 is also known as the Stephen Miller special, by the way. And, you know, along with MPP, which is another Trump era policy, these promises that were made by the then candidate, they remain in place. And again, I think that it's important to have a strategy if you want to execute something very different than what Trump did. And you know, on these two policies, it looks like a failure so far, and it looks like the promises that were made have been broken.
Presumably, a presidency where either the president incumbent himself is going to seek re-election, or he's going to want to have the power to, you know, put his weight behind whomever the Democrats choose in 3 years to be their nominee. Given how clear his language was on that, given that you can sit here and say, here are the promises, they were not kept. What is the calculation you think is going on here about why it's okay to ignore immigration advocates and those for whom reversing the Trump era immigration policies, you know, was an important part of their decision to vote for Joe Biden?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if we go back to the Obama era, with the exception of DACA, you know, that there are some big exceptions, but Obama was known as the deporter in chief. He deported more people year by year than any other president in the history of the United States, including Donald Trump, right? And so this idea that immigration is necessarily going to be the issue which drives voters, I don't know necessarily that that's the way that the Democrats see it. And you know, as a reporter who's covered immigration under Obama and under Trump and now under Biden, I think it's hard in general to get the public to care about immigrants. I think it was a lot easier under Trump because there was this assumption that he was, you know, so right-wing and so anti-immigrant. And it's true that words absolutely do matter. I think that, you know, it did make a lot of people cringe when, and rightfully so, when, you know, Trump used certain language to demonize and criminalize human beings. We don't hear that from the Biden administration. I do think that that's a marked difference. But when it comes to policy, they are very similar. I'm not sure exactly what the calculation is. But, you know, I will say that I think the same exact policies that are playing out under Biden would garner a lot more attention and a lot more public condemnation had Trump still been in office. And what I do see is, you know, this reflexive defense of Biden, protecting Biden and protecting the party. And it's unfortunate, right? You know, then candidate Biden campaigned on this promise of a free and humane immigration system. He specifically said that, you know, it's a national shame when a parent and a child drown seeking entry into the United States. And that was just a year ago. And in September, I think we all saw images of Biden's mounted Border Patrol agents corralling Haitian parents and children at the southern border. And if you look closely at some of those videos, you'll see that there, you know, there's this little kid, this little child, and they're nearly trampled by one of these Border Patrol horses, right? And, you know, one has to question, is that a national shame? Is it only a national shame under Trump, or is it still a national shame under Biden?
All right. I so appreciate this insight. I hosted a television program during the second term of the Obama administration. And I can tell you, just as an empirical matter, that some of our lowest ratings were whenever we would talk about immigration stories during the Obama second term administration. And that is less an indication of something going on with President Obama and more of an indication about sort of our willingness to turn away as a set of audiences from the immigration question and these fundamental questions that persist around public policy. Aura Bogado is a reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Children separated from their parents at the border. Pregnant women detained and deported. Late night and early morning raids and arrests. Citizens racially profiled and treated as alien outsiders, a president who's begun constructing a multi-million dollar border wall. Now, this may sound like a description of America's southern border during the Trump administration, but it's not. This is the reality of the western border of the Dominican Republic, where in the last 3 months, 16,000 Haitians have been expelled. Haiti and the Dominican Republic are neighboring nations of a single island in the Caribbean, and the DR has a long history of enacting racism, classism, and violence against their Haitian neighbors and residents. And the current crisis feels particularly acute in this difficult moment for Haitians whose president was assassinated just a few months ago and whose people are still recovering from the ravages of a recent earthquake. Here's what one Haitian mother told Reuters.
I want to look for a better life because of my children. But now I sit here and think about what opportunities my country has for me. If my country can offer me a new opportunity, I'll stay here. But if I don't get any opportunities, I'll be forced to go to another country.
Joining me now is Danica Cotto, the Associated Press's Caribbean correspondent, who was just recently reporting out of the Dominican Republic. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the DR has deported 16,000 Haitians in the last 3 months. What is happening?
Well, activists say, although deportations have always occurred every year in the Dominican Republic, that this new administration under President Luis Abinader has particularly targeted Haitian migrants in a way not seen before. For example, they say that unaccompanied children are being deported, pregnant women, lactating women, and they accuse officials of arresting people, you know, going against the law, arresting people from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., as well as not notifying their Haitian counterparts about who's being detained and who's being deported and where they're being deported.
Now, are these Haitian citizens or are these DR citizens of Haitian descent?
According to activists, it's everything. It's people who have crossed, Haitians who have crossed illegally into the Dominican Republic. It's Haitians who have long lived for decades in the Dominican Republic and originally arrived there under a work permit provided by the Dominican government that has since expired. And there are tens of thousands of people trying to renew these documents. And activists say that the government has repeatedly refused to do so, which gives them, they say, the excuse to arrest them. And as well, activists say that even some Black Dominicans born to Dominican parents have been arrested and deported.
It would be helpful, I think, for some folks who don't know the particular racial history and history of racial violence, particularly in the 20th century, maybe to understand the context in which this is happening.
Indeed, if we go a little bit farther back from that, the Dominican Republic doesn't celebrate its independence from Spain. It celebrates it from Haiti on the day that it revolted against what was at the time a violent occupation of the Dominican Republic. And since then, both countries that share the island of Hispaniola have had a very fraught and tense and sort of ongoing wary relationship. Back in 1937, under the Dominican dictator Rafael Trujillo, there was an estimated anywhere from about 10,000 to 30,000 Haitians killed, particularly along the western border in the northwest part of the Dominican Republic near Dajabón and other areas. And this, you know, was a result of complaints from Dominicans at the time accusing Haitians of stealing cows, crops, and, you know, and other goods. So this sort of fraught relationship has been going on for decades and has, you know, recently intensified given, you know, the deepening political instability in Haiti, as well as the growing violence in that country that, you know, many are trying to flee, and the closest exit, well, is their neighbor in the Dominican Republic.
So let's talk a little bit about that. Has there been an increase in migration of Haitians across that western border, well, I guess the eastern border for Haiti, into the DR?
It's hard to say to compare it with previous years. According to activists, there has been an increase in deportations, but they say that the flow has not, that there's not been a spike in the flow. I mean, there are a lot of Haitians also who are trying to get to the Turks and Caicos Islands, the Bahamas, and other in Puerto Rico as well. So there's no statistics that other governments can provide in terms of how many people are leaving. But Haiti is also facing, you know, a lot of Haitians who have been expelled by the United States. There have been more than 12,000 expelled since September. And a lot of these people have never lived in Haiti or, you know, have spent decades outside of their own country and don't speak the language. So not only do you have just the regular people who have long been leaving Haiti, you also have those who are arriving and who are trying to leave again. So, you know, you have those two situations coming together.
It's a really useful reminder for Americans. Sometimes we have kind of a short attention span on these kinds of immigration issues. And your point about, you know, what had obviously had people riled up, angry about seeing how Haitian immigrants were being treated at the southern border of the U.S. And yet part of what I hear you saying is that those deportations have now increased the pressure on what's happening here on the island.
Indeed. I mean, you have more people trying to leave just because you have more people being expelled to Haiti. And, you know, Haiti right now is not capable of really providing any resources. I mean, it's nearly impossible to find a job. Some of these people have families who lost their homes in their earthquake. So they're living in temporary shelters and, you know, they don't have a home or a family to stay with right now. And on top of it, there's been a spike, a very big increase in kidnappings. And those, you know, who have been deported to Haiti with families, I mean, they're seeking to leave as soon as possible, given the situation.
Now, when you talk about resources and obviously the clear lack of them, given the circumstances in Haiti, what are the economic resources and opportunities like in the DR?
There's a lot more. I mean, the DR has a very, very strong economy. Tourism, you know, is the main source of revenue along with other sectors. But there's just a lot of work to be found. And as well, a lot of those jobs are not being done by Dominicans themselves. So, you know, the Haitians come in, they fill in their jobs, they get paid less, you know, than their Dominican counterparts. And a lot of them back in several decades ago, it used to be in agriculture. You know, a lot of Haitians worked in sugarcane fields, and then now they're also branching out into tourism, call centers, construction, as well as domestic employment, you know, working as maids for people in Santo Domingo, the capital, and elsewhere.
Oh, well, Danica, am I crazy or does that sound very familiar to another set of immigration patterns?
Indeed. It's very much a reflective of what's happening elsewhere.
Danica, let me just ask this. Given how long this history is, that it is wrapped up with questions of identity and, you know, colonialism and language and race, what's the likelihood of a solution in the near future?
Unfortunately, I don't really see any solution. I mean, the fact is, you know, that these two countries share an island, and the closest exit for Haitians who are unable either to find jobs or, you know, who fear for their lives, because so many people have been caught up in this gang warfare that has escalated, is the Dominican Republic. I mean, they're just, you know, one border away. And when we were along the border town of Dajabón, which is in the northwest part of the Dominican Republic, you would see, you know, authorities bringing in Haitian migrants, or those believed to be Haitian migrants, dropping them off at the border, and we would observe them. We would walk with them. We would walk with the migrants. They would cross over into Haiti, and 20 minutes, 30 minutes later, you know, they were along the riverbanks trying to cross back. So it is, you know, sort of this cycle where they get dropped off, they come back in. And then on top of it, you know, Haiti's situation is unfortunately not likely to get better anytime in the future. I mean, they're still trying to hold elections next year after the, you know, President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated on July 7th. A lot of people are still trying to recover from the 7.2 magnitude earthquake that struck in August, you know, killed more than 2,200 people and destroyed more than 10,000 homes. Plus you have, you know, the spike in kidnappings, you know, everyone being kidnapped from students to doctors to, you know, even we interviewed a hot dog street vendor who was kidnapped. So, you know, everyone's being targeted with that. And you know, there's just a lot of uncertainty. And added to that, on Tuesday, the Haitian government announced that there would be an increase in fuel prices because it can't afford to keep subsidizing fuel anymore. And as you know, there was a recent severe shortage of fuel. You know, hospitals were turning away patients. Schools were not able to operate. A lot of businesses had to cut back on their hours. As a result, you know, people increasingly lost their jobs. So it's just this cycle that keeps perpetuating itself and that keeps driving people more into poverty. And, you know, there's a lot more hunger as well. So the only way for them, for many families, is to just look elsewhere. And not everybody can afford to, you know, pay a trip to the Turks and Caicos or the Bahamas or other islands. So the cheapest way for them to flee is just across the border.
Danica Coto is the AP's Caribbean correspondent. Thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you very much for having me.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry.
And you're an amateur, but yet your life is tennis. And sometimes do you wish you could stop and get off and look back and see what's happening to Arthur Ashe?
Yes, but I really don't want to do that. Sometimes you wish you could, but on second thought, it's not too good because you don't want to look back. I always look forward to the rest of today and tomorrow. What's in the past, and there's water under the dam, and you learn from your mistakes, and you must go from there.
That archival audio from the U.S. Tennis Association features a young Arthur Ashe, thoughtful as always. And while Ashe himself may not have wanted to look back on his life, that's exactly what we're going to do today. This month, a new documentary called Citizen Ashe is out in theaters. And in their film, co-directors Rex Miller and Sam Pollard show how Ashe evolved from someone who initially focused just on the game to an outspoken critic of racism and other forms of injustice. According to the filmmakers, his first Grand Slam victory at the 1968 U.S. Open was a turning point for the athlete.
This U.S. Open victory was sandwiched among Dr. King's assassination, Bobby Kennedy's assassination, the coming Black boycott of the Mexico City Olympics, President Johnson saying he wouldn't run for president, riots in the summer in Newark, L.A. you didn't get 5 minutes to breathe, even though it was a monumental achievement for me.
After winning that Grand Slam, Ash became more willing to voice his criticism on issues like apartheid in South Africa. And this was, of course, a time when segregation was still deeply embedded within the American tennis world. Here he is on WGBH in 1969, talking about those discriminatory policies.
I can play at and use the facilities of lots of these clubs. And as I said, I can't join them, but that's the way it is. It's something like having the only poker game in town. He says, you want to play poker, you play with my rules, or you don't play at all. To that extent, I'm slightly powerless to change a lot of things overnight, but some things are changing.
Ultimately, many of the changes that happened within the tennis world during Ash's lifetime happened because he did take matters into his own hands. Ash mentored a number of other black tennis players before passing away in 1993 due to complications from AIDS. In 2008, Ash's widow, Jeannie Mutusami Ash, went on WNYC's The Brian Lehrer Show to talk about her late husband.
There were so many important issues on his plate that I think Arthur always had the mission of using tennis as a platform to be able to talk about the inequities in life, having grown up in segregated Richmond, Virginia, as he did. So he used that platform very well. He happened to be a really good tennis player. And
you don't win three of the majors around the world, including the U.S. Open.
Not bad.
To learn more about this really good tennis player, I spoke with filmmakers Rex Miller and Sam Pollard about Citizen Ash.
Well, my Arthur Ashe origin story goes all the way back to probably 1966, 1967. I was 16, 17 years old. And, you know, as a young African-American man growing up, I was aware of him being like, you know, this anomaly in the tennis world. You know, this one black player that, you know, you saw playing, you know, out there against all the other players, white players. So I was aware of him back in the 60s. So, but what I didn't know about Arthur then that I learned from working on this film was that he was just much more than a tennis player. I mean, he was an activist. He wasn't like Ali or Jim Brown or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, but he also had a very strong political perspective that even grew even more after he started to really gain a lot of fame and notoriety as a tennis star.
So you walk in initially through the sports world, through the tennis, and then find the activists.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what, and you know, and I think, you know, I think that was Rex's mission as he got into this film, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, to really look at Ash, not only as a phenomenal tennis star, you know, winning the 68 U.S. Open, beating Jimmy Connors at Wimbledon, winning the Australian Open. You know, this was an amazing, amazing athlete, but also an amazing human being. And one of the things interesting in the film at the very end, he says he doesn't want to be remembered just as a tennis player. He wants to be remembered as this man, African-American man, who basically was out there to do more than just be a tennis star.
Rex, I'm wondering, I mean, you also have explored the life of Althea Gibson. I think of, for young people today who know, we're not even that young anymore, the Williams sisters, and moving forward. I wonder if there's something specific about tennis and activism for black players, or if it is simply the nature of being in a sport that is connected with whiteness in the way that tennis is, that also contributes to this position of activist athlete.
Well, my background is very much in tennis. I am the product of two tennis fanatic parents. So I grew up literally in the crib by the tennis court. And my mother, who was Jamaican and a brown-skinned woman, played Althea in 1958 at the segregated Marion Cricket Club. And neither one of them could join the club. It was restricted, but they were allowed to play in the tournament. My mom was a good local player in the New York area. So I come at this story and Althea's from the tennis perspective. But I'd say that I literally got exposed to a great deal of activism through being an admirer of Arthur Ashe. I used to imitate his serve when I was like 8, 9, 10 years old. When I was 6 in 1968, I was at the finals of the US Open in Queens, near where I live. So I come at it through tennis. Arthur and Althea had very different reactions to the pressure of being an activist. Althea came more than 10 years before Arthur. She was a champion in the late 50s. Arthur didn't reach that level till 10 years later in 68. And Althea was very much a reluctant activist. Things were a lot rougher in the 50s, also being a female and being really very much on her own. It was, you know, downright dangerous both for her life and any career she might want to fashion by going out on a limb and demonstrating. And Arthur, as Jeannie Ashe pointed out to me, had a lot of support along the way. He had the support of the church when he was growing up to give him some stability. He had the support of UCLA and then later West Point, the US military, and then the Davis Cup team. All of these institutions and organizations gave him a ground to stand on. And it still took Arthur a while to develop his outspoken activism because, you know, he was the same age as Emmett Till and saw that, you know, through the newspapers and the media, saw that murder take place. And as he says in the film, if you were Black, you know, growing up in the 50s, you knew who Emmett Till was, even if you were illiterate. So Althea and Arthur had different stances on being an activist.
And yet there was some reluctance for Ashe. He, you know, that point earlier, Sam, that he was not necessarily Muhammad Ali in his sort of initial desire to be immediately forthright. Sam, I wonder if you can talk us a little bit through what that reluctance looked like and what pushed him past that. Was it primarily the Emmett Till moment?
I think the reluctance came from the fact that for African-Americans, and particularly African-American men during that period of segregation, you know, if you lived in the South, at any moment you could be lynched. You know, you could be, you know, you could be pulled off the streets, you could be murdered. And I think that the strategy for many African-Americans at the time was not to make any waves, not to make any waves. And I think for Arthur, he grew up like that. He grew up with a father who was very disciplined, who said, here's this world we live in, this segregated world, but you need to figure out how to protect yourself. And the way you protect yourself in white America, in segregated America, is to not make waves, is not to cause any fuss or any ruckus, you know, because you don't want to end up like Emmett Till or Cheney Schwerner, or, you know, or Cheney with Cheney Schwerner and Goodman. So you could see that was sort of his stance and his approach. But I think what you see in the film is that as he started to become much more confident about his skills as tennis, as he started to get more awareness, and by winning that 68 US Open, he felt like he had found his platform. He was now able to say, look at me, I'm a winner at the US Open, and I think I can speak out. And I think he was reluctant to do that before he had established himself and got this reputation. And so after that, as we see in the film, you know, when Hayward Hale Broom interviews him, he was a different man. He was a different man. He was able to speak up now and speak out. Now, the thing to remember, Melissa, he was never going to be like Ali, you know, bombastic. He wasn't going to be like Stokely Carmichael or Huey P. Newton, but he was going to do it the Arthur Ashe way. He was going to still be, you know, focused, disciplined, but speak his mind in a different way. And remember, his brother says, Johnny says in the film, the man that he wanted to emulate was Jackie Robinson. So think back to Jackie Robinson breaking into the major leagues under the guidance of Branch Rickey and being told by Branch Rickey, we want you to be, you know, the symbol of integration for the Major League Baseball, but you can't go out there when people yell at you and call you the N-word or scream at you and throw things at you. You can't fight back, you know, excuse me, you know. And Arthur basically had that same kind of strategy and approach.
I'm wondering if that, the language that you just used, Sam, of his discipline, of his dignity, sort of, you know, I even think of the ways that my own father, who's born just 2 years before Ashe, right there in Richmond, had, you know, sort of talked about how he presented himself. Was that in part, Rex, do you think the military service, that sort of disciplined, buttoned-up way of self-presenting?
Yeah, I mean, Arthur had that buttoned-up manner way before he got to the military. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as Sam mentions, that came from his father, that came from growing up in the capital of the Confederacy, Richmond, in the 40s and 50s. And that was further influenced by his mentor, Dr. Robert Johnson from Lynchburg, Virginia, who had basically a tennis academy, not only for African-American kids, but all kids who wanted to play in that area, primarily African-American kids. But Dr. Johnson picked Arthur in a similar fashion that Branch Rickey picked out Jackie Robinson. There, you know, as the legend goes, there were a couple other players that were as talented or more talented than Arthur in the young years, you know, 12, 13, 14. But Arthur had the discipline and the stoicism, and he was unflappable. And that served him well because, as Arthur said in his words, I was the raisin in the rice pudding, you know, meaning in the other sports, track and field, and then later in basketball and football, there were many more African Americans than just one. But he was the only one, only male player. And even at that point, Althea was done. So he was the only, you know, African American tennis player at the highest level.
And rice pudding is also a particular kind of claim to make about what the tennis world is.
Charles Kuralt says in the film, but Billie Jean King says it a lot of in her appearances. You know, the clothes were white, the balls were white, the shoes were white, the people were white. That was tennis. Yeah.
That is tennis. Sam, can you talk a little bit about the end of Ashe's life and how his death from AIDS reverberated in the sports world?
Well, I think a couple of things, you know, Melissa. First of all, you know, all this sort of emotional and psychological containment, and the fact that he had a family history of heart issues probably contributed to him having these heart attacks. I mean, he, as he says in the film, he couldn't imagine being an athletic young man in his late 30s having a heart attack, but he did. And he had a number of heart attacks. And then he had the blood transfusion where he contracted AIDS, you know, and then he had to deal with that. But the thing to remember, which really speaks volumes about Arthur and also Jeannie Ashe, is that they had a level of discipline and stoicism that they were going to work through everything. You know, these weren't the kind of people. Arthur Ashe was the kind of person who got hysterical, not in public, maybe in private, but I doubt that. And he sort of looked at everything through a very focused prism, you know, and said, how do I deal with this calamity that's impacted my life? And how does he deal with it? By giving back, by starting organizations that's going to deal with people who have AIDS, you know, by always giving back. I mean, very focused. I mean, it's you know, it's interesting to me, Melissa, you know, before I got involved with this film, I just thought Arthur Ashe, okay, I was that black guy who was a good tennis player, you know. He didn't do much, but he did a lot when you really think about it. And one of the things that's so amazing about this film is the audio tapes that Rex uncovered, where how many times have you had the opportunity to watch a documentary, to hear a person who's the focus of this documentary give you his interior thoughts? Mm-hmm. I mean, very, very interior thoughts about his life. I mean, the closest that I've come to this is when I did the Sammy Davis film. Sammy Davis is another one who was very introspective. And it's amazing how introspective Arthur is about his life, about the people in his world, his orbit, his relationships with different people, from Muhammad Ali to Stokely Carmichael, to his feelings of guilt about not being on the front lines when people were protesting in the 60s. Amazing revelations that you get from this man.
Both of you have used the word stoic more than once to talk about Ashe. When I think about the headline-making black tennis player in this moment, Naomi Osaka, and her decision to actually opt out of the Olympics this summer, the multiple conversations we had here on The Takeaway and throughout media around her decision as a young woman of color to, as many, you know, understood it, to put self-care at the core of her decision-making. Would that make her not stoic? Would it make her stoic in a 21st century way? I'm wondering if there is any kind of through line that we clearly see from an Arthur Ashe moment to a Naomi Osaka moment.
She inhabits a different sports landscape than Arthur Ashe did. What with the microscope that she's under as both a woman of color and of, you know, Japanese descent. She's half, her father's Haitian, you know, and her mom's Japanese. So she's got a lot of pressure on her to basically represent both of those races. You know, she gets a lot of money from Asia, all those endorsements, and a lot is put upon her, a lot of responsibility. The exterior that she showed when she was winning the US Open in 2020, where she wore a different mask for all seven of her matches, celebrating and drawing attention to people of color that were killed by the police. I mean, that was totally on her own. So I think that's the through line from Arthur to players like Naomi Osaka and Serena. And we see Francis Tiafoe, up and coming male star from the States, also representing his thoughts and social activist views. So I think that's the through line. And Harry Edwards in the film talks about how athletes these days have the greatest opportunity through this thing called Twitter, you know, social media. They can post their own views. Back in the day, a lot of times if athletes spoke out, it wouldn't even be covered, you know, by the mainly white sports media that was following them. But nowadays, athletes can speak for themselves, and you see them doing it left and right. So I think that's the through line. And with Naomi particularly, you know, I think she's going to rebound and find her core and realize that she has big things to accomplish, mostly off the court. I mean, she's already accomplished a lot on the court. But as Arthur stressed, you know, he wanted to be remembered for things that he did off the court. And I think Naomi's headed in that direction.
I think that Naomi has the same. I do think she has a certain kind of stoicism that is similar to what Arthur has. She's not, you know, she's not outwardly vocal. She's not loud about how she's feeling. But she was, you know, she really articulated that she was going through some, you know, struggles, you know, psychologically, and she felt that she needed to pull back. And I think there's a certain kind of stoicism that she has that to me is similar to Arthur. She's an athlete who says, I don't have to make a lot of big waves to basically say, I need to take care of myself, you know, and this is what I need to do. I'm going to stop playing tennis for a while. So I think she is in line with the way Arthur saw himself and how he reacted to things.
Rex Miller and Sam Pollard, co-directors of Citizen Ashe. Thank you both for joining The Takeaway.
Thank you, Melissa.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks to you.
The complaint we filed today alleges that Texas has violated Section 2 by creating redistricting plans that deny or abridge the rights of Latino and Black voters to vote on account of their race, color, or membership in a language minority group.
On Monday, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against Texas as a result of the redistricting in the state. Over the past 10 years, the population in Texas has grown significantly, and much of that population growth is coming from Latinx, Black, and Asian American communities. The DOJ claims, however, that the new districting maps do not represent that growth, and in fact strip people of color in Texas from fair electoral representation. Joining me now is Michael Lee, senior counsel for the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. Welcome to The Takeaway, Michael.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So talk to me a bit. What are the legal challenges actually outlined in this suit?
Well, there are a couple of challenges in the Justice Department suit. The first is the allegation that Texas's plans were intentionally discriminatory toward Black and Latino voters who powered Texas's growth along with Asian voters last decade. 95% of Texas's population growth last decade was non-white. And yet, when it came time to draw the new maps, Texas created no new opportunities for minority communities. In fact, went backwards, dismantling several very diverse multiracial districts in the suburbs of Dallas and Houston, and failing to create Latino opportunity districts in Houston and Dallas. And that's a second allegation that's in the complaint, which is the maps did not comply with the Voting Rights Act by failing to create enough opportunities. So basically, the allegation is that the maps were both discriminatory in intent and effect.
For those who have followed the redistricting story since Shelby v. Holder, obviously there's a time when a map like this would have had to undergo a Department of Justice pre-authorization review, right? But I guess part of what I'm wondering is, are these portions of Texas that have been redistricted in this way, are they part of what would have previously been covered under that sort of automatic requirement for DOJ review?
Absolutely. You know, Texas, prior to 2013, prior to the Supreme Court Shelby County versus Holder ruling, like other states that had a history of discrimination, was required to get all election law changes, including redistricting plans, pre-approved by the federal government, either by the Justice Department or by a three-judge panel in Washington. And until Texas proved that its maps were not discriminatory, either in intent or effect, it couldn't put them into effect. And that was a really powerful tool. And it was a little bit like having a cop on the block. So maps sometimes weren't that aggressively drawn. But because the Supreme Court struck down the formula for determining what states were covered in 2013, and because Congress has not yet enacted a new formula for determining what states should be covered, that doesn't apply this cycle. And so what you saw this cycle is like really aggressive map drawing that sort of surgically targets communities of color, who again were 95% of Texas's population growth last decade, and really undermines and dilutes their power really for the whole of the decade if these maps stand.
So, Michael, say a bit more about where these population changes have happened over the course of the past decade. Are they in places that people might find surprising, or are they in the kind of stronghold spaces like Houston and these other sort of metro areas?
Well, Texas was the fastest growing state last decade, added 4 million people. And really, the growth is in the urban and especially suburban areas. And, you know, it's the suburban areas that in particular, I think people might find surprising, because it's the suburbs that are getting much more diverse. So take Fort Bend County, for example, outside of Houston, where Tom DeLay, many people will remember Tom DeLay, Republican leader back in the day. But, you know, he was from Fort Bend County back in when he represented Fort Bend County. It was 90% white. It's only 30% white now. And it's very diverse. It's a mix of Asians, Latinos, Blacks, whites. It really is a hodgepodge of everything. And it's in these really very diverse suburbs that a lot of the most aggressive line drawing was done, because I think, you know, those suburban districts have become a lot more competitive for Democrats as multiracial coalitions have come together. And Republicans have decided that they're not going to compete for the votes of Black voters and Latino voters and Asian voters. Instead, they're going to try to gerrymander their way out of a problem. And that's, you know, I think where, you know, a lot of the battles are, but also in the urban areas where, you know, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, for example, Latinos, there are more Latinos in the Dallas-Fort Worth area than there are in the entire state of Colorado. And yet there is no Latino majority district in the area. And all of that, I think, is at the heart of these challenges.
You know, you've said two things here I want to dig into. So first, help people understand what aggressive line drawing means.
Well, there are several examples of it. One, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, there's a congressional district that's about 48% Latino, so almost Latino majority. And what Republicans do is they take a large block of Latinos in suburban Dallas and draw them out of the district and put them instead in a mostly rural district south of Dallas that is a white majority district. So these suburban Latinos outside of Dallas are now in a rural white district. So that's one example. But another example is in Fort Bend County. Fort Bend County has historically been in one congressional district, but what they do, because it's become increasingly competitive, because it's a district where people of color are on the verge of electing a candidate of choice, what they do is they saw apart minority communities in Fort Bend County and put some of them in a district in Houston and leave some of them in the district and fill them in on the backside with rural white voters. And so really what you're seeing is this you know, sort of the creation of these suburban rural districts in order to shore up Republican power and also to lock communities of color out of power.
So the second thing you said that I want to dig into just a bit is the decision not to compete for these votes. I mean, particularly in a state like Texas, demographics don't have to be partisan destiny. You know, again, if we look back even as recently as the presidency of George W. Bush, there was an aggressive effort to bring particularly the Latino voters into the kind of GOP big tent. Why the decision to fold that tent up and not compete for these new demographics that are swiftly growing in the state?
Well, it's a little bit inexplicable, and it may not be very smart in the long run because, you know, it's not as though Texas is going to stop getting more diverse. In fact, it's only going to get more diverse over the course of this decade. And, you know, many of these districts, if you left them in place for, you know, and made modest changes to make sure that they were equally populated, they would be really competitive districts. And in a rational world, Republicans would say, you know, we should go out and find our Latino candidate or an Asian candidate to run. We should go out and try to compete for at least some votes from Latinos and Asians and Black voters. And, you know, like, we don't need very many because these districts are competitive. We don't need very many to win. And we can sort of build, you know, compete for the multiracial Texas of the future. And instead, what they're trying to do is they're trying to gerrymander their way out and kick the can down the road. But in doing so, they may ultimately be riding their party into oblivion because, you know, they are drawing these districts that will elect people who are not very representative of Texas and you know, increasingly will be not very appealing to the, you know, diverse multiracial Texas that is, you know, at the right here and now.
Michael, just one last question that'll probably not be in the live broadcast, but will end up in the podcast version. Or who knows? Who knows what I'll end up? We'll make decisions. but one last question, and that is, any chance the DOJ will actually win this?
Well, you know, the Department of Justice, it's really great that the Department of Justice is in this case and in this case early, because they bring a lot of resources to the table. And, you know, there are a number of suits brought by Black voters, Latino voters and others challenging these maps. But, you know, these are expensive, hard cases to bring in. Having DOJ in the case is certainly great. But at the same time, DOJ will face the same headwinds that everybody else is facing, which is, you know, more conservative courts and a legal framework where, you know, that is much more frayed than it was even just a decade ago. And principally, you know, partially by there's no preclearance, but also because the Supreme Court has greenlighted partisan gerrymandering. And now that created an easy out for the state to simply claim that we were discriminating against Democrats who happened to be Black, Latino, and Asian, but, you know, we weren't discriminating against them because of their race. We were discriminating against them because they're Democrats, and that's okay. And that's an out that the Supreme Court has left, and it's a really dangerous out. And it, you know, if courts aren't willing to dig deep, it may succeed.
Michael Lee from the Brennan Center's Democracy Program, thank you for your time today.
Yeah, glad to be here.
And that's the show for today. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm going to leave you with yet another transformative takeaway. Props to the country of Chile for a landslide victory this week that overwhelmingly approved marriage equality, granted parental rights, expanded adoption access, and ensured spousal benefits for same-sex couples. The hard-fought victory was the result of years of effort by local advocates and was ushered across the finish line by a somewhat unlikely ally, Conservative President Sebastián Piñera, who explained, quote, "I think we should deepen the value of freedom, including the freedom to love and to form a family with a loved one, and the value of the dignity of all relationships of love and affection between two people. Because transformation requires substantive steps towards equity, we recognize the nation of Chile as today's transformative takeaway." Now, if you can think of any other people, organizations, or nations that deserve to be highlighted, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And also, make sure you follow us on Instagram for some behind-the-scenes action. Make our digital editor, Zach, a happy guy. Go see what he's laying down over there on IG. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.